大家好，这里是北京外语广播正在播出的大学生英语在线 Question of the Day， 我是米少米歇尔，今天我们的嘉宾依然是庄庄老师。
Hello everyone, and for today's TED Talk, I'm going to introduce a paragraph by a physician. This physician is by the name of Rishi Manchanda.
听这个名字有点像那个印度的名字哈，但是呢，他从业作为一个 doctor 来讲的话，如果想在北美去从业，一般呢，这个医生呢都是需要经过好多好多年的奋斗啊，从学习到考执照，然后到最后开诊所，所以他那个英文也是没有问题的。
The title of his speech is What Makes Us Get Sick? Look upstream.
Upstream 是上游，对不对？所以他说这个使人生病的原因是什么？
He has worked as a doctor in South Central Los Angeles for a decade, where he's come to realize his job isn't just about treating a patient's symptoms, but about getting to the root cause of what is making them ill, the upstream factors, like a poor diet, stressful job, a lack of fresh air. It's a wonderful call for doctors to pay attention to a patient's life outside the exam room.
所以你看这个人呢，他我觉得他就是属于一个就是当医生，但是不仅仅是治病，把他的活动限于诊所范围，他会去寻根去找到这个病人他的根源是什么，就是所谓的 upstream factors. 然后他列举了三个事儿，我觉得现在就是在中国这三个事儿也是很普遍的。第一个事儿就是 diet，
饮食结构。
比如说 Michelle, what did you eat for breakfast today?
I didn't have breakfast.
你看，这就首先就是一个对健康极其不利的东西，
基础代谢率就下降了。
那你就是吃中午吃的烂吃是什么呢？
Vegetable,
eggs,
tofu, and some rice.
好，那么你这个 diet 呢，可以说呢就是没有什么动物的东西，是吧？
哦 meat，
对吧？这个其实也是一个 unhealthy diet。那在英文中呢，经常会讲 to plan a healthy diet， 你得要去能计划好自己的这个均衡啊。中文就喜欢说 a balanced diet， 是吧？我们不管是什么东西都要吃一点，多样化，保持这个各种营养物质平衡。那么这个 diet 其实是好多人亚健康的一个重要的因素。再来就是 stressful job， 工作压力。
对，精神上的压力，
工作的压力大，是吧？其实学生也是那样，工作和学习生活中呢其实都是压力，但是套用以往我们播的那个 TED， 这个事儿没事儿，关键是要看你的 perspective。 那我们对了，这个压力大呢，你自己要想法变换角度去缓解，那就可以把这个事儿给他解决了，好多的病其实就不会最后跑到去医院看的这个地步。
那怎么能缓解呢？比如说在办公室工作十小时，到厕所笑几声。
你不用上厕所笑，你就到楼道笑就就那个嗨森的笑。人家而且心理学上就说的话，其实你哪怕是自己假笑呢，这个笑也最后变成能够让你的神经调节成好像你是在真正发笑。
对，那得是假笑的大笑，不能是假笑的微笑。你觉得我苦吗？
你那是皮笑肉不笑。那你就大笑好了，是吧？那以后我要在马路上看见一个人在大笑，估计
就是精神压力的，
精神压力的，而且听了今天的节目了。
哎呀，笑得像我一样。
然后他说第三个因素就是什么呢？就是 a lack of fresh air。
就是憋得慌呗，
对，没有新鲜的空气，是吧？许多的办公场所，尤其到了有空调供暖，或者是或者是夏季的这个冷制冷的时候，它的那个空气都不好。
我打算随身带一个氧吧，就那种大罐子，潜水用的是。过来。
然后你也不嫌沉，
我也不嫌沉吧，我后头弄一小推车拉着。
你这个装束太奇怪了。
现在小学生不都是拉自己书包吗？我拉一氧罐，特沉的那种，几吨的那种大氧罐子。
估计进地铁的时候，
蹦蹦，
直接就给您拦在那个安检点之外。
我哪还坐地铁？我都打车把那氧罐放到后头。
没错。这个就是一个这个空气清新。那所以说，大家应该常常去郊外，对吧？上树林里啊，这个植被比较多的地方啊。
拿塑料袋兜一兜氧子回来，放你自己的氧罐。
让我想。还有人想那样攒，攒一些污浊的空气。
对，就是 不同消化方式，不同的食物导致了一些就是不同的产物。
排出的气体，然后再对其化学成分进行分解，
进行闻，就直接
用鼻子闻，那太糟心了这个工作。
进行判断，就是像训练成那种缉毒犬一样的感觉，以后就可以去缉毒去了。
到处都 sniff，
对，
太难受了这个哈
，sniff 完了就叫，
所以说呢，不管怎样，这个清新的空气也是很重要的。所以你在看这个宜居城市的评比里边，是吧？空气的清洁程度，是吧？你那个绿地覆盖的面积比例，是吧？
那个空气清洁程度，就是你到一个山脚上的一个小亭子里，随便一摸都没有土，那种。哎呀，太干净，太干净了
，是吧？
特别想去舔去。舔地
跟缉毒犬又有点关系了，我改用舌头了。
训练出一种动物的本领，
就是啊，动物的本领不能这么干。
嗯，
好，所以呢，这个从大夫的角度呢，他指出来这个导致许多人生病的根本原因，就有这些。那咱们来看一下他是怎么讲的，咱们来听一下录音。
For over a decade as a doctor, I've cared for homeless veterans, for working class families.I've cared for people who live in working conditions that can be hard, if not harsh. And that work has led me to believe that we need a fundamentally different way of looking at healthcare. We simply need a healthcare system that moves beyond just looking at the symptoms that bring people into clinics, but instead actually is able to look and improve health where it begins. And where health begins is not in the four walls of a doctor's office, but where we live and where we work, where we eat,sleep, learn, and play, where we spend the majority of our lives. So what does this different approach to healthcare look like? An approach that can improve health where it begins. To illustrate this, I'll tell you about Veronica. Veronica was the 17th patient out of my 26th patient day at that clinic in South Central Los Angeles. She came into our clinic with a chronic headache. This headache had been going on for a number of years, and this particular episode was very, very troubling.In fact, 3 weeks before she came to visit us for the first time, she went to an emergency room in Los Angeles. The emergency room doctor said, we run some tests, Veronica. The results are normal, so here's some pain medication. And follow up with a primary care doctor. But if the pain persists or if it worsens, then come on back. Veronica followed those standard instructions, and she went back. She went back not just once, but twice more.In the 3 weeks before Veronica met us, she went to the emergency room 3 times. She went back and forth, in and out of hospitals and clinics, just like she had done in years past, trying to seek relief, but still coming up short. Veronica came to our clinic, and despite all these encounters with healthcare professionals, Veronica was still sick. When she came to our clinic, though, we tried a different approach. Our approach started with our medical assistant, someone who had a GED level training, but knew the community.A medical assistant asked some routine questions. She asked, what's your chief complaint? Headache. Let's get your vital signs, measure your blood pressure and your heart rate. But let's also ask about something equally as vital to Veronica and a lot of patients like her in South Los Angeles. Veronica, can you tell me about where you live? Specifically about your housing conditions. Do you have mold? Do you have water leaks? Do you have roaches in your home? Turns out Veronica said yes to 3 of those things, roaches, water leaks, mold.I received that chart in hand, reviewed it, and I turned the handle on the door and I entered the room. You should understand that Veronica, like a lot of patients that I have the privilege of caring for, is a dignified person, a formidable presence, a personality that's larger than life. But here she was, doubled over in pain, sitting on my exam table. Her head, clearly throbbing, was resting in her hands. She lifted her head up, and I saw her face. I said, hello.And then I immediately noticed something across the bridge of her nose, a crease in her skin. In medicine, we call that crease the allergic solute. It's usually seen among children who have chronic allergies. It comes from chronically rubbing one's nose up and down, trying to get rid of those allergy symptoms. And yet here was Veronica, a grown woman, with the same telltale sign of allergies. A few minutes later, in asking Veronica some questions, in examining her and listening to her, I said, Veronica, I think I know what you have. I think you have chronic allergies.I think you have migraine headaches and some sinus congestion, and I think all of those are related to where you live. She looked a little bit relieved because for the first time she had a diagnosis. But I said, Veronica, now let's talk about your treatment. We're going to order some medications for your symptoms. but I also want to refer you to a specialist, if that's okay. Now, specialists are a little hard to find in South Central Los Angeles. So she gave me this look like, really? I said, Veronica, actually the specialist I'm talking about is someone I call a community health worker. Someone who, if it's okay with you, can come to your home and try to understand what's going on with those water leaks and that mold, try to help you manage those conditions in your housing that I think are causing your symptoms. And if required, that specialist might refer you to another specialist that we call a public interest lawyer, because it might be that your landlord isn't making the fixes he's required to make. Veronica came back in a few months later. She agreed to all those treatment plans. She told us that her symptoms had improved by 90%. She was spending more time at work and with her family, and less time shuttling back and forth between the emergency rooms of Los Angeles. Veronica had improved remarkably. Her sons, one of whom had asthma, was no longer as sick as they used to be. She had gotten better, and not coincidentally, Veronica's home was better too. What was it about this different approach that we tried that led to better care, fewer visits to the ER, better health? Well, quite simply, it started with that question, Veronica, where do you live? But more importantly, it was that we put in place a system that allowed us to routinely ask questions like Veronica and hundreds more like her about the conditions that mattered in her community, about where health and unfortunately sometimes illness does begin in places like South LA. In that community, substandard housing, food insecurity are the major conditions that we as a clinic had to be aware of. But in other communities, it could be transportation barriers, obesity, access to parks, gun violence. The important thing is we put in place a system that worked. It's an approach that I call an upstream approach. It's a term many of you are familiar with. It comes from a parable that's very common in the public health community. This is a parable of three friends. Imagine that you're one of these three friends who come to a river. It's a beautiful scene, but it's shattered by the cries of a child, and actually several children, in need of rescue in the water. So you do, hopefully, what everybody would do. You jump right in, along with your friends. The first friend says, I'm going to rescue those who are about to drown, those at most risk of falling over the waterfall. The second friend says, you know what, I'm going to build a raft. I'm going to make sure that fewer people need to end up at the waterfall's edge. Let's usher more people to safety by building this raft, coordinating those branches together. Over time, they're successful, but not really as much as they want to be. More people slip through, and they finally look up and they see that their third friend is nowhere to be seen. They finally spot her. She's in the water, she's swimming away from them, upstream, rescuing children as she goes. And they shout to her, where are you going? There are children here to save. And she says back, I'm going to find out who or what is throwing these children in the water. In healthcare, we have that first friend. We have the specialist. We have the trauma surgeon, the ICU nurse, the ER doctors. We have those people that are vital rescuers, people you want to be there when you're in dire straits. We also know that we have the second friend. We have that raft builder. That's the primary care clinician, people on the care team who are there to manage your chronic conditions, your diabetes, your hypertension, there to give you your annual checkups, there to make sure your vaccines are up to date, but also there to make sure that you have a raft to sit on and usher yourself to safety. While that's also vital and very necessary, what we're missing is that third friend. We don't have enough of that upstreamist. The upstreamists are the healthcare professionals who know that health does begin where we live and work and play. But beyond that awareness is able to mobilize the resources to create the system in their clinics and in their hospitals that really does start to approach that, to connect people to the resources they need outside the four walls of the clinic. Now, you might ask a very obvious question that a lot of colleagues in medicine ask. Doctors and nurses thinking about transportation and housing? Shouldn't we just provide pills and procedures and just make sure we focus at the task at hand? Certainly, rescuing people at the water's edge is important enough work. Who has the time? I would argue, though, that if we were to use science as our guide, that we would find an upstream approach is absolutely necessary. Scientists now know that the living and working conditions that we all are part of have more than twice the impact on our health than does our genetic code. And living in working conditions, the structures of our environment, the ways in which our social fabric is woven together, and the impact those have on our behaviors, all together, those have more than five times the impact on our health than does all the pills and procedures administered by doctors and hospitals combined. Altogether, living in working conditions account for 60% of preventable death. Let me give you an example of what this feels like. Let's say there was a company, a tech startup, that came to you and said, we have a great product. It's going to lower your risk of death from heart disease. Now, you might be likely to invest if that product was a drug or a device. But what if that product was a park, a study in the UK, a landmark study that reviewed the records of over 40 million residents in the UK, looked at several variables, controlled for a lot of different factors, and found that when trying to control, when trying to adjust the risk of heart disease, one's exposure to green space was a powerful influence. The closer you were to green space, to parks and trees, the lower your chance of heart disease. And that stayed true for rich and for poor. That study illustrates what my friends in public health often say these days, that one's zip code matters more than your genetic code. We're also learning that zip code is actually shaping our genetic code. The science of epigenetics looks at those molecular mechanisms, those intricate ways in which our DNA is literally shaped, genes turned on and off based on the exposures to the environment, to where we live and to where we work. So it's clear that these factors, these upstream issues, do matter. They matter to our health, and therefore our healthcare professionals should do something about it. And yet Veronica asked me perhaps the most compelling question I've been asked in a long time. In that follow-up visit, she said, "Why did none of my doctors ask about my home before?" In those visits to the emergency room, I had 2 CAT scans. I had a needle placed in the lower part of my back to collect spinal fluid. I had nearly a dozen blood tests. I went back and forth. I saw all sorts of people in healthcare, and no one asked about my home. The honest answer is that in healthcare, we often treat symptoms without addressing the conditions that make you sick in the first place. And there are many reasons for that, but the big three are, first, we don't pay for that. In healthcare, we often pay for volume and not value. We pay doctors and hospitals usually for the number of services they provide, but not necessarily on how healthy they make you. That leads to a second phenomenon that I call the don't ask, don't tell approach to upstream issues in healthcare. We don't ask about where you live and where you work because if there's a problem there, we don't know what to tell you. It's not that doctors don't know these are important issues. In a recent survey done in the U.S. among physicians, over 1,000 physicians, 80% of them actually said that they know that their patients' upstream problems are as important as their health issues, as their medical problems. And yet, despite that widespread awareness of the importance of upstream issues, only 1 in 5 doctors said they had any sense of confidence to address those issues, to improve health where it begins. There's this gap between knowing that patients' lives, the context of where they live and work, matters, and the ability to do something about it in the systems in which we work. This is a huge problem right now, because it leads then to this next question, which is, whose responsibility is it? And that brings me to that third point, that third answer to Veronica's compelling question. Part of the reason that we have this conundrum is because there are not nearly enough upstreamists in the healthcare system. There are not nearly enough of that third friend, that person who's going to find out who or what is throwing those kids in the water. Now, there are many upstreamists, and I've had the privilege of meeting many of them in Los Angeles and in other parts of the country and around the world. And it's important to note that upstreamists sometimes are doctors, but they need not be. They can be nurses, other clinicians, care managers, social workers. It's not so important what specific degree upstreamists have at the end of their name. What's more important is that they all seem to share the same ability to implement a process that transforms their systems, transforms the way they practice medicine. That process is a quite simple process. It's 1, 2, and 3. First, they sit down and they say, let's identify the clinical problem among a certain set of patients. Let's say, for instance, let's try to help children who are bouncing in and out of the hospital with asthma. After identifying the problem, they then move on to that second step, and they say, let's identify the root cause. Now, a root cause analysis in healthcare usually says, well, let's look at your genes. Let's look at, you know, how you're behaving. Maybe you're not eating healthy enough, and you're eat healthier. It's a pretty simplistic approach to root cause analyses. It turns out doesn't really work when we just limit ourselves to that worldview. The root cause analysis that an upstreamist brings to the table is to say, let's look at the living and the working conditions in your life. Perhaps for children with asthma, it's what's happening in their home, or perhaps that they live close to a freeway with major air pollution, the triggers to their asthma. And perhaps that's what we should mobilize our resources to address, because that third element, that third part of the process, is that next critical part of what upstreamists do. They mobilize the resources to create a solution, both within the clinical system, and then by bringing in people from public health, from other sectors, lawyers, whoever is willing to play ball, let's bring in to create a solution that makes sense, to take those patients who actually have clinical problems and address the root causes together by linking them to the resources you need. It's clear to me that there are so many stories of upstreamists who are doing remarkable things. The problem is that there's just not nearly enough of them out there. By some estimates, we need extremists for every 20 to 30 clinicians in the healthcare system. In the U.S., for instance, that would mean that we need 25,000 extremists by the year 2020. But we only have a few thousand extremists out there right now, by all accounts. And that's why a few years ago, my colleagues and I said, you know what? We need to train and make more extremists. So we decided to start an organization called Health Begins. And Health Begins simply does that. We train extremists. And there are a lot of measures that we use for our success, but the main thing that we're interested in is making sure that we're changing the sense of confidence, that don't ask, don't tell metric among clinicians. We're trying to make sure that clinicians, and therefore the systems that they work in, have the ability, the confidence, to address the problems in the living and working conditions in our lives. We're seeing nearly a tripling of that confidence in our work. It's remarkable. But I'll tell you the most compelling part of what it means to be working with extremists, to gather them together. What is most compelling is that every day, every week, I hear stories just like Veronica's. There are stories out there of Veronica and many more like her, people who are coming to the healthcare system and getting a glimpse of what it feels like to be part of something that works. A healthcare system that stops bouncing you back and forth but actually improves your health, listens to who you are, addresses the context of your life, whether you're rich or poor or middle class. These stories are compelling because not only do they tell us that we're this close to getting the healthcare system that we want, but that there's something that we can all do to get there. Doctors and nurses can get better at asking about the context of patients' lives, not simply because it's better bedside manner, but frankly because it's a better standard of care. Healthcare systems and payers can start to bring in public health agencies and departments and say, let's look at our data together. Let's see if we can discover some patterns in our data about our patients' lives and see if we can identify an upstream cause. And then, as importantly, can we align the resources to be able to address them? Medical schools, nursing schools, all sorts of health professional education programs can help by training the next generation of upstreamists. We can also make sure that these schools certify a backbone of the upstream approach, and that's the community health worker. We need many more of them in the healthcare system if we're truly going to have it be effective, to move from a sick care system to a healthcare system. But finally, and perhaps most importantly, what do we do? What do we do as patients? We can start by simply going to our doctors and our nurses, to our clinics, and asking, is there something in where I live and where I work that I should be aware of? Are there barriers to health that I'm just not aware of? And more importantly, if there are barriers that I'm surfacing, if I'm coming to you and saying, I think I have a problem with my apartment or my workplace, or I don't have access to transportation, or there's a park that's way too far, so sorry, doctor, I can't take your advice to go and jog. If those problems exist, then, doctor, are you willing to listen? And what can we do together to improve my health where it begins? If we're all able to do this work, doctors and healthcare systems, payers, and all of us together, we'll realize something about health. Health is not just a personal responsibility or a phenomenon. Health is a common good. It comes from our personal investment in knowing that our lives matter, the context of where we live and where we work, eat, and sleep matter, and that what we do for ourselves, we also should do for those whose living and working conditions, again, can be hard, if not harsh. We can all invest in making sure that we improve the allocation of resources upstream, but at the same time, work together and show that we can move healthcare upstream. We can improve health where it begins. Thank you.
好的，今天的节目分享的内容就是这些，希望对大家有帮助。我们明天节目见，再见。
The other people watching me, and we're all people watching the other people watching we, and we're as lonely as we wanted to be.
下一期大学生英语在线将继续为您带来 TED Talk 的内容。
接下来您将听到的是私房拷贝。Coming up next is home video.
Dream of